Okay. We are in Judges chapter 19. And the connection in this story as well is third generation. What is the name of the priest?
Are we way in 19 already? Boy, I've missed out.
No, we're two.
We jumped.
We jumped to 19 because he's going chronologically.
Oh, okay.
Phineas. Phineas.
And the stories at the end.
Phineas is the priest in this story. So this is third generation. This is before the first of the judges is actually listed, and the first of the judges is Othniel, son of, is it Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. That would be third generation. Jonathan in the previous story, grandson of Moses, third generation. The story with Jonathan and the Danites and the turning to idolatry and the making of graven images is an illustration of how quickly they had turned away. Moses brought the people of Israel out of Egypt. That first generation turned away. Then Joshua and Caleb were the two faithful spies, second generation. And as Moses led the people of Israel for the 40 years, Joshua and Caleb were that second generation. And Moses hands things over to Joshua for the entering into Canaan, the promised land. And as Joshua goes through and does the wars and the battles and the conquests, then there's a third generation that's coming along. And the third generation includes Jonathan, grandson of Moses, and Phineas, grandson of Aaron, who's now acting as the priest, the high priest, serving in that office. And the Israelites are turning away. In the first story, they turned away through idolatry. And when there is no God and no truth that you're accepting in your life, will there be any morality? That's the testing out that this story illustrates. And as we go through it, this is one of the nastiest stories of the Bible. Brace yourself. There's more than enough blame to go around. So we won't be trying to figure out who's in the right, because that just isn't there. And so we begin chapter 19, the infamous crime. Verse 1, in those days when there was no king in Israel, and they say it over and over again, there's no law, no pattern, no right and wrong. A certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. Is she his wife? Is she not his wife? She's kind of a second-class wife. She doesn't have the standing of a wife, but he's married her. Verse 2.
And his concubine was unfaithful to him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months.
Okay. Other translations may say that she played the harlot. Okay. We've got right away two people that we can attach some blame to. He wasn't willing to make her his wife fully, just a concubine. And then she plays the harlot and then runs off to her father's house back in Bethlehem. Okay, 4 months later, verse 3, then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. I'm going to pause there and let you, in your mind, fill in some background story here. Why does he have to speak kindly to her and bring her back? Had he treated her unkindly? That's a probably. Okay. He had with him his servant and a couple of donkeys. And she brought him into her father's house. And when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. So he wants his daughter going back with the Levite. Verse 4.
Now his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him, and he stayed with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there.
Okay. Treated him friendly and persuaded him to stay, et cetera, et cetera. And on the fourth day, they arose early in the morning and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go. And we see where this is going. Verse 6.
So the two of them sat and ate and drank together, and the girl's father said to the man, be pleased to spend the night and let your heart be merry.
About this point, he should be thinking, am I ever getting out of here? And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law pressed him till he spent the night there again. Verse 8.
On the morning of the fifth day, when he rose to go, the girl's father said, refresh yourself, wait till the afternoon. So the two of them ate together.
Wow. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry, and tomorrow you shall rise early in the morning for your journey and go home. Now, he maybe should not have given in all of those nights, but let's find some blame. Verse 10.
But unwilling to stay another night, the man left and went toward Jebus, that is Jerusalem, with his two saddled donkeys and his concubine.
Okay. Old name for Jerusalem, alternate name for Jerusalem, and Bethlehem, remember, is about 5-6 miles from Jerusalem. It's not that far, if I remember correctly. I might not be remembering correctly, but it's not far. when they were near Jebus, the day was nearly over, and the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to this city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." So third generation, what do we know? They're making friends with the people of the land, and there's commerce between, and on and on and on it goes. Is this a good idea? No. It gets worse.
Who is the servant that said to his master, is that the concubine?
No.
Oh.
No, it's just a servant.
Oh, okay. I didn't see where it said a servant departed with them.
We don't know of what nation that servant is.
Oh.
He is suggesting they stay in a Jebusite city. So we don't know. That's one of the details that never gets filled in.
I was confused. I see in verse 9, it says he and his concubine and his servant. So
right.
I wasn't putting the servant with them yet. Okay.
Okay, verse 12.
And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah."
Yeah, or Gibeah. Now, background. What do we know about Gibeah and the Gibeonites from back in the book of Joshua? If I were to say the Gibeonite deception, would that ring a bell?
Were they the people that came and said that they were travelers?
Yeah, we're from very far away. Look at our bread. It's all moldy and everything. We want to make an agreement with you that you will not attack us and kill us off. And they didn't consult with God. And they made the agreement. And about 3 days later, they found out, oh, the Gibeonites live right over there. And they go to march the army to Gibeah, but they can't kill them because they made an agreement. So they tell the Gibeonites that they are to be slaves and servants. And they will work at the house of the Lord. Now, from what tribe is this servant's master? Is from the tribe of Levi. And that means he may have some duties at the house of the Lord. And they're traveling on, and the master decides, well, we'll stop at Gibeah. Gibeah is in the territory of Benjamin. That becomes very important later on in the story. Okay, verse 13. And he said to his young man, that would be the servant, "Come and let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah." So Ramah is close into Gibeah. Verse 14.
And they passed by and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin.
Okay. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no one took them into his house to spend the night, which is kind of odd in the ancient world. If you were a traveler and of some means, people would welcome you in to keep you safe, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There may be a reason for that. This may relate to what happens later. But verse 16.
That evening, an old man from the hill country of Ephraim, who was living in Gibeah, the men of the place were Benjamites, came in from his work in the fields.
Okay. So Benjamites were living in Gibeah, and Gibeonites were living in Gibeah. Okay. Not the best that it could be, but they swore that they wouldn't kill them. Verse 17, and he lifted up his eyes and saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, where are you going? And where do you come from? Verse 18.
And he said to him, we are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to the house of the Lord, but no one has taken me to yourselves.
Okay. I've got a note, comes over from Delitzsch. This is verse 18, who translates it, I walk at the house of the Lord, and no one receives me into his house. Delitzsch says, because he served at the house of the Lord, no one at Gibeah would receive him into his house. Although he adds in verse 19, he had everything with him that that was needed. The argument is taken from the indignity shown him. The Lord thinks me worthy to minister to him. I walk at the house of the Lord as a Levite in his house. And there is not one of the people of the Lord, Benjaminites, who thinks me worthy to receive his hospitality. That's quite some decline in how people thought about their God and the worship of the house of the Lord. Third generation.
How did the people know that about him? He hadn't even talked with anyone, or how did they know about that?
In part, it could be attire, because certain professions wore the clothing of that profession, and because you didn't have too many clothes, you pretty much settled on you were going to wear the clothing of your attire or the clothing of your job. So
maybe he had a collar on.
Well, yeah. Picture you see me in the collar with the tab in going into Menards, and you say, a pastor's here.
Right. Okay.
The Levites had some very specific clothing things that they would do. The priests, even more so. The rabbis later on had very distinct clothing, and although they were not acting as priests to serve in the temple, not all of them, they had clothing that was related to the religious occupation. So Paul could go into a town, and because Paul had been a student and a rabbi, he could slip on his rabbi clothes and go into the synagogue, and they would recognize him and invite him to speak. Oh, sneaky, right? But for this Levite, that means nobody's going to take him in. He's abandoned in the town square, which in most town squares, that's not the safest place to be. Even in good periods in a country. So let's see. Verse 19, we have straw and feed for our donkeys with bread and wine for me and your female servant and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything. Verse 20.
And the old man said, peace be to you. I will care.
Hold on there.
Okay.
When he greets him with peace be to you. Is this an Israelite greeting a fellow Israelite?
No.
It's a hint that it could be, actually. So, meanwhile, this old man's not going to be faultless in this whole thing. He'll have his share of blame, but go on.
I will care for all your wants, only do not spend the night at the square.
Why? So he brought him into his house and gave the donkeys feed, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. Okay, verse 22.
While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him.
Yeah, with the classic euphemism that we may know him. Dalich notes that the form of the verb banging on the door indicates that it was, it started out banging on the door and then it escalated to banging really hard on the door and kept on going, escalating. Okay. So verse 23, and the master of the house went out to them and said to them, no, my brothers, do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing. Okay. And this vile thing would be what?
Have sex.
It would be gay sex. And we know that that is specifically what is talked about as a vile thing from the next verse. What does the next verse say?
Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I will bring them out to you now, and you can use them and do to them whatever you wish. But to this man, don't do such a disgraceful thing.
How far have these people fallen in their morality?
Well, and the Levite just let it happen too.
Yeah, that's another verse along or so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But.
Well, the poor girls.
Let's distribute the blame here for this verse. The man, the host, is offering up his virgin daughter and the other man's concubine to be violated and raped. And he's offering this up as that would be better than what you're thinking of doing. Nothing's good in any of this.
No.
But he must feel like there's too many of them to fight off or protest.
Yeah, the burn down his house or something.
Yeah.
So we get to verse 25. But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. Dalich says, this is the master of the house, the host, seized the other man's concubine. And that would be with his permission. Why'd he go all the way to Bethlehem to win her back if he was going to throw her away like that? What kind of relationship had there been where she ran away in the first place? No good options for her. And her husband, what's the old word, cad? He's about as worthless as anybody else in this story. And the host is not acting as a proper host. Okay. So the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them, and they knew her and abused her all night until the morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. This is a horror. 26.
As morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was until it was light.
Yeah. Okay, that part of the horror is complete. But we've got more blame to assess and dole out here. Verse 27, and her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. From Dalich, did he expect her?
No.
He figured she would never get out of it alive and he would never see her again. But there she was at the door.
Well, it also appears he went and slept the night too, because she got there at day break and she laid there till daylight when he came out to leave.
Yeah, he wasn't worried.
No.
Did they go back to drinking and making merry?
Probably.
What a sensitive guy.
No wonder she ran away from him.
Okay. Now she's inconvenienced him because he has to step over her. Verse 28.
And he said to her, get up and let us be going. But there was no answer. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place.
Oh my God. I just read the next verse. Oh.
Well, it's worse than it appears.
Ah.
It is worse than it appears. So the next verse, and when he entered his house, he took a knife and taking hold of his concubine, he divided her limb by limb into 12 pieces and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. Okay. There were other incidences where you would take a body and cut it apart into different pieces and send it. Dalich calls one of those to mind. And that is when your neighbor has, killed your prize bull, and you're sending the pieces around for people to join you in demanding that he give repayment. you cut the bull apart and send it around. For example, it's how you do with an animal that is your property that has been damaged and killed by someone. Yeah. So she's property. Yeah, that's pretty much how he treats her. Verse 30.
And so it was that all who saw it said, no such deed has been done or seen from the day that the children of Israel came up from the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, confer, and speak up.
Okay. Which means there never was a woman abducted by fellow Israelites and treated in that way and killed in that way. Not since they came out of Egypt. There had been some standard of morality, and now it had failed completely and they'd fallen out through the bottom. What to do? Well, when they decide what to do, are they going to get it right?
Doubtful.
Doubtful. So chapter 20. Then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba. And this is Dan in the far north after the Danites had moved to the far north, some of them, and taken the grandson of Moses with them to set up idols up there. To Beersheba in the far south. That's where they say from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead. That would be east of the Jordan. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. Okay. Verse 2.
The chiefs of all the people of all the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that explored.
Now the people of Benjamin heard that the people of Israel had gone up to Mizpah, and the people of Israel said, tell us, how did this evil happen? Okay, so they are inquiring, they are calling for anybody who's a witness, who knows anything, who can say anything about this. Okay, who's going to speak up? Verse 4.
So the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, I and my concubine came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the leaders of Gibeah, doesn't say that earlier that it was the leaders, does it? No. Mm-hmm. Methinks he might be embellishing a little bit here. And the leaders of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house against me by night. They meant to kill me, and they violated my concubine, and she is dead. It may be a reasonable suspicion that they would have killed him because he is the one that they wanted. He is a Levite, and to defile a Levite is an offense against God, is it not? Well, to defile and kill a concubine is an offense against God. But he is one who serves at the house of the Lord. So, and that's why he couldn't get any lodging for the night and was staying in the square until the old man found him. Okay, verse 6.
(Clears throat)
I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and disgraceful act in Israel.
Behold, you people of Israel, all of you, give your advice and counsel here. Okay. Verse 8.
So all the people arose as one man, saying, none of us will go to his tent, nor will any turn back to his house.
But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. We will go up against it by lot. Delich suggests that the by lot means, and after we have destroyed and burned it to the ground, by lot, we will divide up the possessions that are remaining, the spoils of the war against Gibeah, to be distributed to the 12 tribes. Verse 10.
And we will take 10 men of 100 throughout all the tribes of Israel, and 100 of 1,000, and 1,000 of 10,000, bring provisions for the people, that when they come, they may repay Gibeah of Benjamin for all the outrage that they have committed on him, Israel.
Okay.
Is it possible that she was dead or dying when he picked her up and put her on the donkey, since she didn't respond and maybe had died along the way by the time he got her home?
Almost all of the commentators would say, no, she was dead. She was dead.
She was dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That appears to be what happened. But what they're arranging here is for supply lines and food and other things, so that the army, the other 9 men out of 10, can go up to Gibeah and fight, and the 10th man, or the 1/10, arranging for supply lines. So all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man. Verse 12.
Israelites sent messengers to the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what a terrible thing has been done among you.
Okay. So now they have decided that they will take up arms, but first let's communicate with the people of Benjamin and say, for example, verse 13, now, therefore, give up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and purge evil from Israel. But the Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the people of Israel. So they took the side of the culprits. Why?
That must be how far they've fallen.
Mm-hmm. I made a note in my margin somewhere that says, my side, right or wrong. Doesn't matter whether they're doing right, doesn't matter whether they're doing wrong. They're my folks, so I'll take their side no matter what. It's a party spirit that allows a lot of evil to go on because, well, I don't want to act against them because they're my group.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This happens also in our day in families. A child does something terribly, terribly wrong, and the parents, well, it's our flesh and blood. We are going to do whatever we can to protect him. We're watching that play out on a national stage right now, with this guy that apparently killed his girlfriend. And his parents are apparently helping him to hide somewhere and somehow. And the latest thing is that their lawyer has forbidden them to talk to their daughter, because if they let something slip, then they could incriminate themselves. Yeah. We've gotten into that mess, haven't we? Okay. Verse 14.
From their towns, they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites.
Oh. And the people of Benjamin mustered out of their cities on that day 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who mustered 700 chosen men. Verse 16.
Among all this people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss.
Whoa. And the men of Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of war. Verse 18.
The people of Israel arose and went up to Bethel and inquired of God, "Who shall go up first for us to fight against the people of Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Judah shall go up first."
What's missing there? You don't need to answer. It's an interesting thing to keep in mind. What's missing there? Then the people of Israel rose in the morning and encamped against Gibeah. Verse 20.
And the men of Israel went out to fight against Benjamin, and the men of Israel drew up the battle line against them at Gibeah.
The people of Benjamin came out at Gibeah and destroyed on that day 22,000 men of the Israelites. Wow. 22.
And the people, that is the men of Israel, encouraged themselves and again formed the battle line at the place where they had put themselves in array on the first day.
And the people of Israel went up and wept before the Lord until the evening, and they inquired of the Lord, "Shall we again draw near to fight against our brothers, the people of Benjamin?" And the Lord said, "Go up against them." What's missing? There is sorrow there. What's missing? Verse 24.
Then the Israelites drew near to Benjamin the second day.
And Benjamin went against them out of Gibeah the second day and destroyed 18,000 men of the people of Israel. All these were men who drew the sword. Verse 26.
And the Israelites, all the people, went up to Bethel, and there they sat weeping before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and presented burial offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord.
Oh. And the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, for the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. Okay. And here's our link to, this is the third generation, verse 28.
With Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, ministering before it, they asked, "Shall we go up again to battle with Benjamin, our brother, or not?" Oh, the Lord responded, "Go, for tomorrow I will give them into your hands."
Okay. The two previous times they did not inquire whether they should go. just who shall go first? And shall we go? But not shall we go or shall we cease? That's the second day. And at first, they're just full of their courage and believe that their courage and their might and their righteousness is going to prevail. And after two defeats, then they're not only filled with sorrow, they're also repenting, they're fasting, they're offering offerings and sacrifices, and calling everything into question. They had not had the proper temperament to go up and be successful. They went up with the pride of their own might, and that failed. But now they humble themselves before God.
So how is the Lord communicating with them at this time?
Through Phineas and Urim and Thummim, where you can inquire and ask questions. And we don't know exactly how the Urim and Thummim were set up to work, but that was how they inquired. And Phineas was faithful, so he was one where they could get a straight answer from God through him. He wouldn't hedge his phrasing or soften anything for them. So we get to verse 29. So Israel set men in ambush around Gibeah. Think about the battle at Ai. Verse 30.
And the children of Israel went up against the children of Benjamin on the third day and put themselves in battle against Gibeah as at the other times.
And the people of Benjamin went out against the people and were drawn away from the city. And as at other times, they began to strike and kill some of the people in the highways, one of which goes up to Bethel and the other to Gibeah. And in the open country, about 30 men of Israel, that's how many would have died in the initial battle, 32.
Well, the Benjamites were saying, "We are defeating them as before." The Israelites were saying, "Let's retreat and draw them away from the city to the roads."
And all the men of Israel rose up out of their place and set themselves in array at Bel Tamar. And the men of Israel who were in ambush rushed out of their place from Marah Geba, west of Geba. Verse 35. Oh, sorry, verse 34.
And there came against us Gibeah 10,000 chosen men out of all Israel. And the battle was hard, but the Benjamites did not know that disaster was close upon them.
And the Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and the people of Israel destroyed 25,100 men of Benjamin that day. All these were men who drew the sword. 36.
And the men of Benjamin saw that they were beaten. The Israelites had retreated from Benjamin's warriors in order to order to give them a hiding in ambush, more room to maneuver against Gibeah.
Then the men in ambush hurried and rushed against Gibeah. The men in ambush moved out and struck all the city with the edge of the sword. 38.
Men of Israel had arranged with the ambush that they should send up a great cloud of smoke from the city.
Mm-hmm. The men of Israel should turn in battle when that happened. Now, Benjamin had begun to strike and kill about 30 men of Israel. They said, surely they are defeated before us as in the first battle. Verse 40.
But when the signal began to rise out of the city in a column of smoke, the Benjamites looked behind them, and behold, the whole of the city went up in smoke to heaven.
Then the men of Israel turned, and the men of Benjamin were dismayed, for they saw that disaster was close upon them. 42.
So they fled before the Israelites in the direction of the desert, but they could not escape the battle. And the men of Israel who came out of the towns cut them down there.
Mm-hmm. Surrounding the Benjaminites, they pursued them and trod them down from Nohah as far as opposite Gibeah on the east. 44.
18,000 men of Benjamin fell, all of them men of valor.
And they turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. 5,000 men of them were cut down in the highways, and they were pursued hard to Gidom, and 2,000 men of them were struck down. 46.
So all who fell of Benjamin that day were 25,000 men who drew the sword. All these were men of valor.
But 600 men turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon and remained at the rock of Rimmon 4 months. And 48.
Men of Israel went back to Benjamin and put all the towns to the sword, including the animals and everything else they found. All the towns they came across, they set on fire.
Okay. Is there going to be a Benjamin? A tribe of Benjamin? And at this point, it becomes doubtful. So, into chapter 21. Now the men of Israel had sworn at Mizpah, no one of us shall give his daughter in marriage to Benjamin. Okay, and if there's nobody to marry the Benjaminites, will there be a tribe of Benjamin?
No.
Yeah.
At verse 2.
And the people came to Bethel and sat there till evening before God, and they lifted up their voices and wept bitterly.
Okay. And the reason why they're weeping is because they took it too far. And they said, O Lord, the God of Israel, why has this happened in Israel that today there should be one tribe lacking in Israel? Verse 4.
So it was on the next morning that the people rose early and built an altar there and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings.
Mm-hmm. And the people of Israel said, which of all the tribes of Israel did not come up in the assembly to the Lord? For they had taken a great oath concerning him who did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah, saying, he shall surely be put to death. What do you think? Did they go too far? A few ways. Okay, multiple ways they went too far. Verse 6.
Now the Israelites grieved for their brothers, the Benjamites. Today one tribe is cut off from Israel, they said.
Okay. What shall we do for wives for those who are left, since we have sworn by the Lord that we will not give them any of our daughters for wives? I made a marginal note about that point. The marginal note says runaway voters assembly. They're going to make decisions. Are they good decisions? Verse 8.
And they said,
you go.
What one is there of the tribes of Israel that did not come up to the Lord to Mizpah? And behold, no one had come to the camp from Jabes Gilead to the assembly.
For when the people were mustered, behold, not one of the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead was there. Verse 10. Runaway voters assembly.
So the congregation sent 12,000 of the bravest men there and commanded them, go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword, also the women and the little ones.
This is what you shall do. Every male and every woman who has lain with a male, you shall devote to destruction. Verse 12.
So they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man intimately, and they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, which is in the land of Canaan.
What? Guess what, girls? It's your lucky day. Get ready for your wedding.
You can tell they're making these decisions themselves and not consulting God.
Yep. In an assembly, even. Has anybody had experience with a runaway voters assembly? Sheesh.
Mm-hmm.
The one has an idea. It's worse than the idea that was previously there, and it just keeps ramping up worse and worse. And then, okay. Let's see. Then the whole congregation sent word to the people of Benjamin who were at the rock of Rimmon and proclaimed peace to them. 14.
Benjamin returned at that time. They gave them the women whom they had saved alive of the women of Jabesh Gilead, but they were not enough for them.
Yeah, there were 600 soldiers and 400 girls. And the people had compassion on Benjamin because the Lord had made a breach in the tribes of Israel. Okay, verse 16. Still, runaway voters assembly. Verse 16.
And the elders of the assembly said, with the women of Benjamin destroyed, how shall we provide wives for the men who are left?
And they said there must be an inheritance for the survivors of Benjamin, that a tribe not be blotted out from Israel. Verse 18.
Go ahead.
However, we cannot give them wives from our daughters, for the children of Israel have sworn an oath saying, cursed be the one who gives a wife to Benjamin.
So they said, behold, there is the yearly feast of the Lord at Shiloh, which is north of Bethel, on the east of the highway. That give them directions even. On the east of the highway that goes up from Bethel to Shechem and south of Lebona. Verse 20.
And they commanded the people of Benjamin, saying, go and lie in ambush in the vineyards.
And watch if the daughters of Shiloh come out to dance in the dances, then come out of the vineyards and snatch each man his wife from the daughters of Shiloh, and go to the land of Benjamin.
And when their fathers or their brothers come to complain to us, we will say to them, grant them graciously to us, because we did not take for each man of them his wives in battle, neither did you give them to them, else you would now be guilty.
And the people of Benjamin did so and took their wives according to their numbers from the dancers whom they carried off. Then they went and returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and lived in them. 24.
So the children of Israel departed from there at that time. Every man to his tribe and family, they went out from there, every man to his inheritance.
And one more time. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Why was there no appointed king at that time?
God was their king.
God was to be their king. Did they live as if God was their king?
No.
No.
They wanted a king.
And they, no king. That's a two-sided thing. So on the one hand, everything goes wrong. On the other hand, when you have a king, he restricts what you and your children are allowed to do in terms of, can I set up a shop and do this as a livelihood? And the king says, no, I have this friend who's going to do that there. Hadn't set it up before, but now, since you've pointed out it's a wonderful opportunity, I'm going to take it away from you. Samuel warns them about what a king will do. They don't listen. We want a king. We want a king. We want a king. Most of the kings went bad because they had absolute authority. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Why our nation is set up the way it is, to restrict the power of the government, because power corrupts. Okay, they read their Bibles. Samuel, however, I'm buying into at this point that he was probably overseeing or doing the compilation of the book of Judges. And he could look back on, before he had anointed a king, these are the things that took place. This is the downside. They need judges. How badly do they need judges? How badly do they need judges?
Pretty badly.
Yeah. Yeah. The bottom falls out of their morality. But before that, they forget completely that the Lord is God. And he's not an idol made of silver or gold and carved in any way. They're worshiping the Baals and worshiping God as if he was just another one of that type of God, which he is not. They have downgraded God to be simply a force of nature God that you could treat the same way as you treated the Baals and hope in the same way to get the same kind of answer, and do not realize that God is, well, to put it in one simple word, God. So this sets the stage for still third generation now. Othniel, son of Kenaz, brother of Caleb, nephew of a second generation person. And Othniel will begin the registry of the judges, and then we walk through 300 some years or more of judges, which means next time we meet, we'll be going back to chapter 3. The next time we meet will not be next Tuesday, because there's a pastor's conference all day Tuesday and half of Wednesday. So if you mark your whatevers, we will resume on the 19th and we'll get into the judges, the actual judges who serve God. And these judges are in little ways pictures of the Christ to come. And some of them will be able to trace that. Others, the mention is too brief to be able to make the connection, but they're there in the list. And that's all I have.